There's another word. Introduce you to one more word, a Pali word, relevant to this kind of conversation. Nibbida. N-I-B-B-I-D-A. Nibbida. And translated often as the word disgust. Disgusting. To be disgusted. It's a bit of a harsh word. So I want to unpack that a little bit because it's part of this. It's used, the best example it's used is, which I think is very clever, is there's a dog. Pretend you're that dog, and you're ranging around out there somewhere. And you come across an old carcass, and you find this old bone. And you, being a dog, know that you like bones, and you like licking and juicing and gnawing them, and then getting into the bone marrow, and you can go on for the longest time with a bone. We all know that dogs like bones. So you find this old carcass with this old bone, you get this bone, and you go off with this, and you sit down with it, and you nuzzle around the nose, and then chew around on the bone, and you get into the ends, and it's got nothing. It's dry, and there is no morsel of smell or juice or anything on it anymore. It's way too old. And after you've fiddled around for ages trying to extract some pleasure from it, there is none. And you go, ugh, and you cast it aside. That's nibbida, disgust. It's not that it's disgusting, it's not horrible. It's just that it cannot do what you think it's going to be able to do. It just doesn't work. It's useless. Forget it. Hopeless. You discard it. You discard it because there is no joy in doing it. Well, that's what happens to thinking in time. As we meditate, enough of our experience is freedom from struggle, that when we struggle, it's so disgusting. It just so doesn't work. All it does is cost. It doesn't help. We can't make things better the way we want to. We can to a degree. We can give ourselves an aspirin when we have pain, and we can, go shopping when we need food and so on. Absolutely, on the course it works. But that's only on that level. On the deeper level, we want real happiness, real deep satisfaction. That behavior of the mind, our whole way of surviving, doesn't do it. Can't do it. So the doing of it again and again, it becomes seen through. We reach that state of nibbida. It's just pointless. So we don't need to give it up. We don't give anything up. This isn't like, you mustn't do this. No, 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 you'll be bad if you do this. At all, like I began this talk. It's simply, we understand it's pointless to keep fabricating and believing in my thoughts and having all these opinions and judging people and scheming. It's just exhausting, and it doesn't help. What really helps is not doing any of that. What really helps in the way that I deeply want is this peace. I just have to stop doing that. And in the moments that I stop, there's just this presence. There's just this quiet awareness without this adding and no churning going on in the background and no little agenda being run all over the thing. Just here we are. It's ordinary, it's simple. It's exhausting and neurotic, and without it, it's easy, easy. Sweet. But we oversee it, we overshoot it, we're looking for more, for bigger, for better, for something other. We're in that old mode. So we miss these opportunities, which are all. That's all I want to say about this topic. I hope some of this landed in some way that could be useful to you. And what I'd like to suggest is that you just sit quietly with that without getting into chit-chat. Now, just take a 5-minute period or so and stretch our legs, pee briefly, want, drink, and so on. But stay quiet. Well, just let this stuff stay with you for a few minutes, and then we'll do some Q&A. And so see what that brought up for you, if there's anything that you want me to elaborate on or that you want to discuss. Let's just see if we can do that for a while. If that's okay with you, but it's now 8. That sound okay? So I'll ring the bell here in, 6 or 7 minutes or something like that. So initially, I'd like to request that any questions you might have or things you want to share, you may have your own, it doesn't just have to be ask me something, but share what this means for you to on this topic. And then after a few minutes, if sort of run down on the topic, then you've got other things you want me to talk about, or you want to discuss with me or ask questions about more generalized or other forms of your practice or something like that, then I'm happy also to take that time and share that with you if that's helpful. About this giving up part. Hi, and we'll say your name, Julie, right?
Julie, yeah.
Yeah.
on the topic of renunciation and giving up, I'm interested in, I believe it's one of the five precepts about abstaining from drugs and alcohol.
Yeah.
I'm interested in expanding on that topic.
Yes, great topic. So, abstaining from giving up. The precepts are offered as guidelines. They're not rules, they're guidelines. If you were a monastic in a monastery, then you would be asked to live within those guidelines. But and it's interesting now because all of these teachings have come from the monasteries and they've now come west, and there's so many more lay people. So even in those countries where people are lay practitioners, they'll many a time go and stay in a monastery and then act as if they were monastics for a period of time, say a month, and then live their lives outside of that. But they've come from that. So when you're a monastic living this way, then they are much more like strict. But when people live outside in lay life and take these guidelines, how far do you take the guidelines? They're sort of open for interpretation. Because they're not like hard and never, but they're guidelines. That particular guideline is, particularly in the West, interpreted quite in various ways by various people. So some people like to say, I mustn't imbibe the goods which could lead to inebriation. But some say, I won't become inebriated. So if I, for instance, me, Heather, will drink half a glass of cider, if I drank 3 glasses of cider, I'd become inebriated. But I know if I drink half a glass of cider, I won't be. So then that's me interpreting that line there. So it's a very slippery slope, you can imagine. But it's about, it's easier to give a guideline that says don't do something than it says do the opposite. The point of all the guidelines are to help us become more awake. And so to become inebriated, you know, means it's impossible for this, giving up this little activity of the mind is very hard anyway, but certainly when we're even more heedless because of alcohol or pot, whatever it is. And so the mind just runs crazy, you know, when you stimulate it with stimulants like that. So it's just counterproductive. The idea is to be as heedful and mindful all the time as possible. But to say, I'm going to do that, it's really hard. It's an ideal. You can say, okay, I'm giving myself a boundary, and I'm not going to go over this boundary, and I'm not going to become affected by drugs and alcohol. Then my mind has a fighting chance of doing what I'm wanting it to do, which is be mindful and present and clear. So it's easier to give it a boundary than to give it an ideal. It's easier to apply it. But again, that boundary is going to have to be open to interpretation. You're going to have to be skillful with it. So it's not a rule to not break so much, but a practice to be conscious of and be careful with. But in terms of relinquishing, it's like relinquishing the craziness of mind that happens when our minds are already untrained. You know, when you're young and you've not done meditation, then you sit down, you are one of the everyone else in the room who didn't put your hand up when I said we were able to do that successfully for 3 minutes. It's hard to do. And so it's impossible to do if the mind is under the influence of alcohol or depending on what the drug is, what the chemical is, but it's impossible. And so it just gets really going. You know, when you get stoned, it's just like, whoa, full of pictures and stories. And So you have to figure it out for yourself. No one's going to judge and say, oh, yeah, she's all. I remember my earliest meditation experiences was in a particular school, a particular tradition, and they were very strict with their, they weren't very strict, it's like, you mustn't eat even egg powder or beef tallow in cookies, you mustn't have sex before marriage, you mustn't this, you mustn't this, you mustn't this. And then people would, I listen, and people would say, so-and-so's off the path. You know, because they've gone and they've, but they're having sex and they're not married, you know, it's like, you know, so this is sort of pass-fail, a whole setup. The Buddha isn't interested in any of that. The Buddha's interested in if you can become free, how best to become free, you'll find that if you engage things which stimulate heedlessness, then it's not going to be possible. And so you have to choose. It's like your own decision. And it isn't just you and your own decision, it's also where you choose to place yourself and in whose company and what activities, and, you know, because it's like, okay, if I myself am okay, take another precept, I'm not going to lie. But I'm living in a milieu where everyone is pretending something, that's really hard. You know, like you need to, it's not just you yourself, it's also the whole situation you choose to put yourself in, you know, what's supportive and what's, you know, whatever the word is, unhelpful, undermining, that's the word. Is that useful?
Great.
Hi.
Hello, I'm Skaya.
Hi, that's right.
My question sort of follows through with that. When I don't succeed at this whole concept of renunciation, the word I've kind of adopted, the problem is deprivation. I cross some tipping point into deprivation, and at that point, I don't care that I'm going to have long-term bad consequences. At that point, I'm simply going to do the short-term fun, bad from the long-term thing. Can you speak a little bit about that word deprivation, how you avoid feeling deprived when you renounce something that is really, really fun?
It isn't about that. It isn't actually about that. That's what, you know, when I first read that first quote by Matthew Carr, when I first spoke about, it's easy to misinterpret this word renunciation because we don't want to do that. We already feel so easily inadequate, and then we're going to misbehave on top of it. But we don't want to think about any of that, because if we do, it's got that negative connotation of deprivation. This is just a drag. I'm not going to even think about that, and I'm jolly going to go ahead and have a blazing good time. So it's not about that. It's about much more, not about what we do. None of our meditation training, when we shift from our survival mode, normal way of thinking, to our dharma mind, dharma awareness. It's not about what's happening, what we're doing so much, as how we are. How are we? And so to have a view of deprivation, to even feel that, it's like miserable and suffering, and then thinking about it, becoming blind to what all of that means. Whereas what the Dharma is asking us to do is be more aware, not less, and to be tuned into the sweetness and the deliciousness of the wholesome states of mind, and to be really aware of how unpleasant it is when we don't do things which are wholesome. You know, there's another teaching, I don't want to, again, I'm not sure who all is here and what interests you, so I have to just guess. But one of the things which I really like is the teachings on Hiri Ottapa. And I don't know if you've ever heard of this. So H-I-R-I, Hiri, and Ottapa, O-T-T-A-P-A. Somehow Ottapa reminds me of some kind of exotic African antelope. There must be one with a name quite like that. And Hiri is sort of a sweet word. They go together, and one of them, and I hate the original translations, they're way too uptight and Victorian and judgmental for me, and they are moral shame and moral dread. And those just sound dreadful as far as I'm concerned. But what they really mean is, the feeling that we all have that when we are about to do something which is not such a good idea, we go like, uh-oh, it's an inner kind of shrinking feeling. Well, when we've done something, we've gone and put our foot in our mouth, we've just gone and said something, it's like, when we realize that was not skillful, that was offensive, or that was like completely ignorant, or that was, you know, we didn't even realize it, and we feel bad, you know, that little pricking feeling. It doesn't have to be a huge moral shame, but it's kind of like, we know better when we have that response. One is here, I never remember which is one. One is before we've done it, one is after we've done it, really. But it's that same pricking of conscience feeling. But this said, when we have that pricking feeling, I call it wincing and cringing. When we wince or when we cringe, those are beautiful. He said, those are the guardians of the world. Because if you didn't have them, you'd be dangerous. You'd be doing all kinds of things that you would be causing harm and upset, and you know, you'd be going around stomping on people and treating people really poorly and so on. And so they are that moral compass that's like, I'm not going to finish this sentence, that's not a good idea. I suddenly realized, I'm about to say something and then that wouldn't work, that's not good. And so they're protectors. So we need to be aware of those things. Not, I'm not going to think those thoughts, I'm not going to be aware of those feelings, I'm going to go ahead and get completely drunk and be thoroughly offensive. That's the opposite. That's when you feel like deprivation. I'm going to go and be really, really stupid and cause harm and not think about it. That's the opposite of what the Dharma is. So the Dharma isn't about preventing yourself from having a good time. It's just keeping aware of the beauty, the wholesome state that we want to feel peaceful inside. We want to be friendly. We don't want to offend people. We don't want to put ourselves down and hate ourselves. We don't want those feelings. They're painful, oppressive, not leading to happiness and well-being. They're not freeing. They're unwholesome. And so not to feel that we're depriving ourselves of anything. We're actually harming ourselves if we don't pay attention to our hearing and otapa. Those little sweet little... We're all tender and vulnerable, and we all know really well. It's when you don't, you're a psychopath. That's what's wrong with psychopaths. They don't know that. You have those functional, so they can do unbelievably terrible things, which is why we're all so shocked by IS at the moment. You know, that it can actually do the things that it can do in the most gruesome way and not have protection. It's terrifying. Boko Haram.